This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan. The Tokyo Olympics 2020 has come and gone. It was a rather strange affair this time around as stadiums and arenas were empty due to the COVID-19 crisis. Nevertheless, Malaysia successfully brought home two medals, a bronze in badminton and a silver in cycling. Now, while we may have once again been unsuccessful in clinching the coveted gold medal for our nation, our athletes still gave us plenty to celebrate about and be inspired by. So joining me on the show today to discuss Malaysia's journey at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics is Kishanan Sundaresan, also known as Mud Stats these days. He's a sports journalist. Welcome to the show, Kish. How are you doing?
Hey, Dashran. How's it going? Thank you for having me on the show.
All right, let's dive right into it, Kish. Let's start with your overall thoughts on the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. I mean, you've been working tirelessly over the past few weeks to a month, covering all the events, particularly Malaysia's journey in it. What are your overall thoughts?
I wouldn't say we've been working crazy tirelessly. Like, there's a larger team at Astro Arena that's done the bigger chunk of the work. But I think, in general, the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, there was a lot of skepticism heading into it, right? Obviously, with the whole pandemic in the background, there was a lot of question marks raised as to whether, two things, as to whether it was even right for it to go ahead. But then there's also the other part, which is looking at, will it be held successfully, safely? I think the first part of that question, it's still up for debate. It's still something that people will continue to talk about, whether it was right or not. I'm still very torn about it. Mm-hmm. Because a part of me, whilst I can understand, exactly what the Japanese people feel about it. I can exactly understand the massive amount of risks that went into making this event a decent success. But at the same time, I also understand what it has done for people. It has galvanized broken spirits around the world. Some of the countries that you saw won medals are countries that are currently, battling severe COVID pandemic. They're battling economic situations. So the performance at the Olympics, the way their athletes have represented countries at the Olympics, including our Malaysian athletes, I think it has galvanized our spirits to a large extent. And the second part of the question, which is, was it held successfully? I think to a large extent, yes. I was even having this conversation with my colleagues. I think if there was a country out there that was going to pull off this Olympics in the middle of a pandemic, chances are it would probably be Japan.
Yep.
Right? Like, let's not kid ourselves. So in that sense, I think it was a massive success to the way it was held. Things were safe. Things was very manageable. And at the end of the day, you can't complain much, right? So from my point of view, I think Tokyo 2020 was a resounding success.
Okay, fantastic. So now let's talk about some of the Malaysian athletes and what their journey at the Olympics. So the first medal we successfully won at this campaign was the bronze medal in badminton, specifically the men's doubles category. Now, unfortunately, Aaron Chia and So Wui Yik, they couldn't bring home Malaysia's first ever Olympics gold medal. But at the same time, you have to look at it. It's this pair's first ever Olympics, and they managed to defeat some of the best teams in the world, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever you're mentioning, the fact that it's their first Olympics, that's the first thing to take into context. Second thing is that they managed to beat some of the world's biggest pairs, and lose against some of them, and come back to then beat them in a bronze medal match as well, which I think is a big testament to the character that you have. The reality is, when it comes to Aaron Chia and So Wui Yik, it's a pair that has been built as the future of the Malaysian men's doubles contingent. We must not forget that in 2019, these guys were All England finalists. Right. They put on a very strong show at that point, even at a very young age, right? So there was a lot of hopes already back then. They've had their ups and downs, which is very natural for a pair of their age, for a pair that's at the stage of the career that they are at. Ups and downs in 2020, and even when you look at the way things have unfolded with the pandemic and everything, you can understand people having consistency issues. When the badminton calendar resumed this year, 2021, with the whole bubble. There were a couple of tournaments that took place under bubble in Thailand. Mm-hmm. They were the Malaysian pair that did really well to some extent in Thailand. Exceeded expectations there as well. And they showed us glimpses of how they've actually been doing quite well in terms of coping with the pandemic, right? Because first tournament after, you know, close to a year of not competing, and boom, you did quite well. And I think they've just built on that and carried that momentum into the Olympics. And the thing that was very glaring for me about them at the Olympics, there was this sense of fearlessness. And I don't know if it's something that stems from the fact that they're inexperienced, or it's something that stems from the fact that it's their first ever Olympics. What I absolutely enjoyed about watching them was there's this sense of fearlessness that came from that, you know, youth naivety. It was both a strong point and a weak point, because in some of the matches, you could see that it really came back to bite them. They didn't know how to handle certain pairs. They didn't know how to handle crucial moments when the pressure was being shifted on them. They didn't know how to realign their strategies in the middle of a game at times, which is natural for a pair as young as them. But also that sense of fearlessness helped them in some of the games, like especially in that quarterfinals when they went up against the world number one, the Indonesian pair, and they completely just smashed them in straight sets, which was, for me, one of my favorite ever So Woo-yik, Aaron Chia performances, right? They're so dominant. But obviously, things didn't happen in the semifinals. And again, when it came to the bronze medal match, there was this question mark of like, can you respond? Can you bounce back? Because the same pair, two things, right? They are supremely experienced, the Indonesian pair, Hendra Setiawan and Muhammad Hasan, supremely experienced. And the thing about them is they also beat Aaron Chia So Woo-yik in the group stages. And they beat them in a way that was very clear to see that it all boiled down to experience and ability to read and manage game. And to me, the way Aaron Chia and Woo-yik bounced back in that bronze medal match was absolutely incredible. So for me, right, on many hands, I'm not saying that it wasn't about the bronze medal. I think the bronze medal for me was obviously important. Mm-hmm. But to me, what I valued more was the way they responded against the pair that had so much of composure and used every bit of experience to outsmart them in the group stage. And it's easy for, I was half expecting that to happen again. But the fact that it didn't, the fact that Aaron Chia and Woo-yik were able to switch their strategies, even in the middle of the match, the fact that they were able to turn on the pressure against a pair that had completely defeated them, I thought that was incredible. To me, that was a symbolic win. A win that will be remembered by many, not just for the bronze medal, but for the way in which they responded to a pair that had resoundingly defeated them in the group stages.
Now, Kish, let's switch gears a little bit, because as we mentioned, you know, Aaron Chia and So Woo-yik, they are in the sort of early stages of their sporting career. They have many, many, at least a couple more Olympics to come, right? But on the other side of the spectrum, our second and final medal from Tokyo 2020 came in track cycling, where this time it's someone on the later stages of his career. We're not too sure whether he has another Olympics under his belt left. He's this 33-year-old Dato' Mohamad Azizul Hasni Awang. Most of us know him as Pocket Rocket Man. He clinched the silver medal, and this is a step up from his previous showing in Rio where he won bronze. I mean, Kish, your thoughts on Pocket Rocket Man's silver medal?
I mean, where do I even... When it comes to Azizul, I think we can have an entire episode talking about him, because to me, he is the beacon of what it means to be absolutely world-class. Mm-hmm. I'll just rewind back to January, or rather end of December last year, 2020, when for a work project, I had to do interviews with him and his coach, John Beasley. And I had never spoken to John Beasley before. And I remember talking to John Beasley specifically. We were talking about Azizul's crash at the 2011 Manchester Track World Cup, where there was a piece of timber that penetrated his leg. And he still got up, got on the bike, and finished the race to get bronze medal, which to me is one of the most, if not the most, iconic Malaysian sports moments ever.
Right.
And we were speaking about Azizul with John Beazley, and John Beazley was just kept saying, I don't think Malaysians quite realize just how world-class Azizul is, just what a superstar Azizul is. Because everywhere you go in track cycling meets around the world, there is so much of attention on him because he's such an unorthodox athlete in a sport that banks so much on, you know, sheer brute force and power. And Azizul, here's a guy that's not as big, that is much smaller than all his competitors, but he comes in with a lot of heart and a lot of slickness and tactics that just makes him such a difficult rider to reach, such a difficult rider to compete against. He's a completely different ballgame, you'd say, when it comes to tracks like cycling. And it's one of those things, because track cycling isn't exactly a sport like football or badminton that's very endearing to Malaysian citizens, right? Let's be real. We love track cycling at the moment because of Azizul, but it's not a sport that is accessible. It's not a sport that we watch or we play or we, you know, participate in all the time.
Yeah.
But the reality is Azizul is absolutely world-class. And you could see it even in the way he reacted after winning the silver medal. That sheer frustration on his face, the way he broke down out of frustration, because he knew he wanted gold. He knew he could win gold. And if you speak to experts and if you speak to track cyclists, they would tell you that yesterday in that final match, had things just gone slightly different, Azizul would have won gold.
Yeah.
Obviously, we could spend hours talking about the track cycling tactics and the way it works and all that. But in very simple words, you know, the fact that Jason Kenny was allowed to pull away very early on, and the fact that the Australian rider ahead of that chasing pack didn't close him down, made things very difficult for Azizul in the end. Had he gone ahead, had he, you know, attempted to break away early on, he might not have even won a medal. But he had to stick to his tactics, and in the end, that got him a silver. But he knew that had things operated slightly differently, that a goal was within his hands. He also knew that Jason Kenny, part of the reason why he would have did the unthinkable, because you don't usually see breakaways like that in Kirin. You rarely do. And the fact that Jason Kenny did it, you could even argue, you could even make a case for to say that it would have been influenced by watching Azizul's performances in the heat and in the semifinals, where he was just completely dominant. So again, when it comes to Azizul, it's a very frustrating one, because you know he has worked his socks off. You know, he's been in Melbourne since 2007. He's won the world championship gold medal when it comes to Kirin. Even at the Olympics, his strategy, the fact that they limited his participation in sprint, they didn't want to go too far in sprint so they could rest, recuperate and focus on his main event, which is the Kirin. They did everything there, everything to perfection. But when it came to the final bit, things just, you know, spiraled out of control, and there was nothing much he could do about it. And in the end, he did everything he could to get the next best thing, which is the silver medal. And that alone is very satisfying. And in reality, we will all go around celebrating success like we have been doing over the last 48 hours or 24 hours or so. But the reality is, you know, Azizul Hasni Awang will feel this heartbreak for a while. And hopefully, once he's processed it, then we will get a bit more clarity as to whether there will be one more attempt at winning the gold. Because Sir Chris Hoy won the gold at the age of 36. And in 2024, Azizul will be 36.
Yeah.
So honestly, Dashrin, fingers crossed that happens. But even if it doesn't, no one can deny what Azizul has already done for this country. He's an absolute monster.
An absolute monster of an athlete. Indeed, he is. Now, let's, Kish, talk about the ones that, you know, they came incredibly close, but, you know, just couldn't quite bring home a medal. I think the first name that comes to mind for a lot of Malaysians is, of course, diver Pandilela Renong. She is a two-time Olympic medalist, amazing talent, but something didn't quite click this time, did it? I mean, she never truly seemed 100% in the zone, or maybe 100% at the best. That's it. Despite not being at the best, I mean, if you look at how she got to the final, she had to really scratch and claw her way, and she really did. And she booked her a position in the finals. Just couldn't quite bring home the medal.
It's very interesting, Dashan, because the thing with Pandelela is I was having this conversation with a couple of colleagues too. We were talking about, obviously, there is a need to be very positive around the way we talk about our athletes, because they have put in the work, they've put in the hours and the sacrifices for years to even get to this point. But at what point do we also draw a line and, you know, genuinely, with an open mind, discuss underperformance, right? Mm-hmm. Discuss instances where athletes have not necessarily lived up to the expectations on their shoulders. And in Pandelela's case, you could argue that it's one of it. It's a perfect testament to that. Obviously, I would preface this by saying that I think 2020 Tokyo Olympics, more than ever, there needs to be leeway given to athletes, because we're not competing under normal circumstances, right? You look at the amount of athletes that just broke down. Let's not even look beyond Malaysia. Even Malaysia alone, quite literally every athlete was breaking down at the end of it, at the end of their competitions, in interviews. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a surprising thing, because you know what they've been through. You know the amount of hours that they've spent away from their families, being in high-pressure situations, trying to retain a competitive mindset at a time where even surviving alone is already a bonus, right? Like, it's we're living in crazy times. Mm-hmm. And so the way we've got to always manage our expectations in terms of that. But I think Pandelela herself, even if you ask her, she herself would admit that it was underperformance at the Olympics. Because especially when you take into context that just a couple of months prior to that, Pandelela became world champion.
That's right.
In diving, she won she won gold at the FINA World Diving Championship. Granted, at that tournament, the Chinese divers weren't there, and the Chinese divers are just cut from a completely different cloth. Right? There's no, I can't even process it. I can't even make sense of it. It's just ridiculous. but Pandelela, whilst competing with the Chinese divers was always going to be a difficult thing. I think Pandelela, at the bare minimum, let's not even talk about medals. I think she definitely knew that she could have done far better in both the events. The one that she competed with, Leong Mani, I think it boiled down to a few mistakes. I think Pandelela made one. I think Leong Mani also made a couple. Understandable. And then when it came to Pandelela's solo event, the 10-meter platform event, it was very heartbreaking, because during the heats, during the preliminary round, or the qualifying rounds rather, she didn't exactly stand out, but she did enough. She did enough to scrape through the barrel, you know, finished 18th, the last spot, qualified for the semis. In the semis, there was this much improved performance from her. We saw a version of Pandelela that was a lot closer to the one that we know of. And she did really, really well in the semis. But imagine doing all of that. Imagine building that momentum. And just a few hours later, after you've gotten some rest, you know, a couple of hours of sleep, you come back and you're in the final and your mindset is perfect. You're there to compete. And on your first dive, things just go completely haywire.
Yeah.
And that just ruins it. Because anyone in diving, especially at the highest level like the Olympics, when you're in the final, when you get a first dive like that, at the end of it, you know it's over. You know the medal is over. Mm-hmm. And for someone like Pandelela, who's obviously at the Olympics to win medals, she's not there to compete. She's there to win medals, right? For someone who's there to win medals, I think it's supremely difficult to compose yourself after a first dive like that. Because yes, you can go on and, you know, and think about participation and doing as well as possible. But how? You are there to win medals and you know that your hopes are over. The moment your first dive is like that, your hopes are over. So in many ways, what I will give her absolute credit for is the way she bounced back after that first dive. The second dive was incredible. I think a lot of people could and would have crumbled under pressure. But I think Pandelela didn't. But she herself would admit that it was underperformance. After what she did at the World Diving Championship, with the reputation and experience that she has, I think she will acknowledge that she could have done far more. But I hope even in terms of public perception, even in terms of how the sporting association or even the National Sports Council views it, I hope there will always be that extra layer of disclaimer to the fact that ultimately we were competing under extraordinary circumstances.
On the show with me today is sports journalist Kishanan Sundaresan. After the break, I'll be asking him if the Malaysian government should start reallocating funds from football to sports that the country is actually thriving in, sports like badminton, diving, perhaps even track cycling. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Kishanan Sundaresan. He's a sports journalist. These days, he's also known as Mart Stats over at Astro Arena. And we're talking about the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, more specifically, Malaysia's journey at this Olympics. So, Kish, you know, we talk about the sport of diving, and we talk about how perhaps Pandilela really did not perform to her to the best of her abilities. But on the other side, there is perhaps a new star that is born in the world of diving, at least among, when we talk about Malaysian athletes, and that is the 22-year-old Nur Dabita Sabri. Now, this was her second Olympic showing. She finished fourth, just missing out on the bronze medal. You know, again, it's a case of so close yet so far, but talk to me about how she, you know, ended up winning the hearts of Malaysians, across the country.
It's a personality, isn't it, Dashran? Mm-hmm. It's the way she just carries herself. It's the chirpiness that comes with her, the spirit of competition. When I watch Dabita at the Olympics, I'm reminded of what the Olympics is about, right? It's that spirit of competition. I'm not saying that you shouldn't feel the pressure. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be 100% focused. I think all of that is normal, and especially at the highest level when so much of things is at stake. But the Olympics is ultimately about competing. It's ultimately about meeting others. It's ultimately also about having fun and all that kind of stuff. And we see that fine blend in Dabita, in the way she manages her pressure by having fun. And it's really refreshing to see. As an athlete, I don't think there's any question marks about Dabita. Even from the time she made her debut at the 2016 Rio Olympics, it was pretty clear that this girl is the future of Malaysian diving. She's relentless. She's hardworking. The hours that she puts into training is ridiculous. And in the build up to the Tokyo Olympics, she's obviously gone through a lot, and she opened up about it. And that's the thing that I like. There's two things I liked about her at the Tokyo Olympics, right? Putting aside the performance, because I don't think we need to talk much about the performance. The reality is she did really well to finish fourth. Mm-hmm. It's an upgrade over her performance at Rio. And it's clearly putting her on the right track. And she wasn't, massively far away from the top three. And when you think about everything that she's been through over the last, 12 to 18 months, I think to come out of it and finish fourth at the Olympics, you deserve everything. And what I liked about her is two things. One is she gave herself that credit, because I saw a lot of athletes just feeling very broken and frustrated about the fact that they had failed the nation, when in reality, we understand what they're going through. But in Dabita's case, there was this very refreshing sense of awareness about the situation around her, acknowledging the fact that she has been going through a lot of stuff, and it has been very difficult for her. And she precisely said, I lost myself. And we know what that feels, especially in the current climate. I'm pretty sure a lot of us have had phases where we felt like that too. Mm-hmm. And we know how difficult it can be. And for someone to come out of a slump like that, to the point where you're going to the Olympics and you win, you come so close to winning even a medal, I think that's, absolutely incredible. And I like the fact that she gave herself the credit, that she said that I'm not crying because I'm frustrated. I'm crying because I'm super proud of myself, mm-hmm. that I know how much I had to work to get here. And the other thing I liked about herself is that she was very open about her mental health situation, which is a discussion that I feel that we definitely don't have enough when it comes to the context of Malaysian sport. And in many ways, I was very glad, because throughout the Olympics, one of my favorite things about observing, the discourse on social media is that, especially on Twitter, that there was a lot of acknowledgement for the mental health situation of our athletes, the amount of stress that they put themselves through, the amount of pressure that they put on their shoulders. And I think Dabita being very open about it at the age of 22, is very, very important for every single young kid out there who looks at Davita as a source of inspiration.
Certainly. I mean, she was definitely a source of inspiration, perhaps one of the most inspiring interview clips to come out of the Tokyo Olympics 2020.
Because
she really, like you mentioned, Kish, you know, she talked about how, you know, things that a lot of us, you know, we may not be athletes, but a lot of us may be going through with our own line of work, you know, with our own personal lives, our struggles because of the COVID-19, because of the lockdowns, you know, how our own mental health may have taken a hit. And to see the world-class athlete who went through the exact similar things and then, you know, still put in the kind of effort and grit and to come out fourth place and to add, talk about these issues, I thought was very, very inspiring. Now, Kish, are there any other Malaysian athletes that you'd like to highlight or some of the stories that you thought were very inspiring, despite them or perhaps not performing to their best of their abilities or bringing home a medal?
Well, honestly, mm-hmm. If people observed the coverage on Astro Arena, one of my favorite things about, because even I am new with Astro Arena, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been here for about a year. And one of my favorite things about Astro Arena is that we've got a bunch of reporters who are very passionate about telling stories. And the storytelling that they were doing at the Tokyo Olympics, some of it was just incredible because they were portraying the actual reality of a lot of the personal journeys behind these athletes there. You know, I think everyone would have seen that clip with Lee Hak Wei. And I think Lee Hak Wei needs to be talked about a lot more because I still remember being in high school and hearing Lee Hak Wei's name at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And like, what, 12, 13 years later, here he is still at the Olympics at the highest level. And obviously, he crumbled under pressure. He says that he said that he couldn't get a feel for things at the Olympic high jump event. He struggled for it. And in the end, he didn't even hit the basic heights that he usually does in training. And so there was this massive frustration about him in the end. That's why he broke down. He teared up. Even our reporter teared up, broke into tears, thanking him, saying that he shouldn't be sad because the reality is he has worked his socks off so consistently in his field for the last, you know, 15 years of his life. He's given it to Malaysia. And there was no need to be, you know, to be apologizing for it because he's given it his all and that Malaysians thanked him for it. And the thing is, with someone like Hak Wei, he doesn't get all the attention he deserves because the high jump, you know what it reminds me of, like, Dashran? It reminds me of R&R.
Right.
Like you know, when we're growing down, we go to all this, when we're growing up, we go to all these rest areas in between our trips.
Yes.
And a lot of these rest areas, you know, are run by, you know, people who are passionate about cooking. They cook their meals and they sell. But the reality is, rest areas are always, you know, a stopgap measure, something that, you know, you stop, you have your meal and then you move on. You don't necessarily think a lot about it. You don't necessarily think about the stories of people who work there because it's one of those things that's just on the sidelines. And to me, the high jump event is something like that, right? When it comes to athletic, everyone always just focuses on the sprinting, on the long distance running. Even in the context of Malaysian sports as a large, we're always focused on badminton. We're always focused right. on track cycling. We rarely ever think about, you know, things like high jump and all that kind of stuff. And I think Hak Wei doesn't get the credit that he deserves for the years that he has put into Malaysian sports. But the one other athlete that I also want to mention, who I think has been brilliant, is Azri Nabila, our female sprinter. And let's just put it a bit into context, right? Azri Nabila traveled to the Tokyo Olympics without her coach. Without her coach by her side, she got a wildcard entry to compete in the 100 meters. She's a young Malaysian sprinter, you know, from Terengganu. And at a first ever Olympics, in an event that is as daunting as 100 meters, alongside world-class athletes, she traveled without her coach. And you know how difficult that is? Like, that's, you know, for reasons I don't even want to get into because then the conversation becomes like hyper-political. But the point is that she traveled there without her coach.
Yeah.
And to me, that's astonishing. And the fact that she had to, you know, she was on Zoom with her coach, she was on Skype with the coach, on WhatsApp with the coach every day. And she was feeling the intense pressure. And when push comes to shove, when it came to the time where she needed to perform in the 100 meters in her first heat, she completely blistered through it and broke her personal best record. And that qualified her to the next stage, to the next heat. And I think that's absolutely incredible. And obviously, she's nowhere close to some of the biggest names in 100 meters, right? Because in the next heat, her competitors in the second heat were, you know, people that are ranked fifth in the world, people that have personal best that are almost like 1 second faster than her, you know, giants of the sport. And obviously, when it came to the second heat, Arjun Nabila eventually got knocked out. But to see the way she competed, despite all the difficulties that she's had, despite being completely new, despite coming from a country that has this massive inferiority complex when it comes to the 100 meters or when it comes to, you know, events like this, right, where we've just generally not done well on the global stage. I was so, so inspired by performance. And I don't even know how to phrase it in a way that can carry the weight of what she accomplished. I think she's an absolute inspiration. I think the things that her coach Bala Murugan was even saying after her performance was just very, you know, it was very inspiring. And I think there's a big future for Arjun Nabila. She's an absolute superstar.
Now, do you think there is enough emphasis put on on a lot of the sports we've been talking about throughout this show, diving, badminton, cycling? Is there enough emphasis put on these sports by the Malaysian government? Because, you know, after Azizul Awang's silver medal yesterday, there were many people on Twitter who said that perhaps it's high time the government, you know, start seriously reprioritizing, you know, where they spend the money and start pumping more money into these sports instead of, say, football. What are your thoughts on this?
I have a very... it's one of those things that I've thought about a lot, primarily because I think, like, for example, like my bread and butter sports would definitely be football, right?
That's right.
It's the one that that I spend most of my time in, that I cover the most, that I consume the most as well. And there's a very interesting thing. It's a very interesting situation to look at, because I think when it comes to sports, there's a couple of different types of sports. I think there are sports where, for example, like track cycling, for example, like diving, where, you know, when it comes to the Olympic stage, it's not so much about what the sport does for the community. It's more about the athletes that are representing the country and just the sheer desire to see them do well and be absolutely world-class in it. Whereas I would contextualize football as a very different sport, because even the origins of football, the way it came into existence and the way it's consumed worldwide now, it's very much part of our social fabric. It becomes a weekly affair. It's a community sport. Mm-hmm. It's something that you consume or you go to on a weekly basis. To you know, distract yourself from your life or to escape as a form of escapism, and it's a sport that's consumed very differently from all the other sports. And so, whilst a part of me genuinely feels from a very logical standpoint that if we have several sports in Malaysia where there is clear potential and we've always had athletes that are incredibly world class in it, I definitely think they deserve far better funding. Mm-hmm. I think it's astonishing that some athletes travel to the Olympics without coaches, for instance, right? Whether it's funding issues or whatever, to me, doesn't make sense. So I think funding is definitely essential to grow the next generation of these athletes. A clear example, right? Let's not kid ourselves. Azizul Hasni has been, pushing boundaries at the highest level, like an absolute global superstar. Part of it is because he has spent a large portion of his life since 2007 living and training in Melbourne.
That's right.
Competing in the Australian mm-hmm. circuit, competing in the New Zealand track cycling circuits, things that are not necessarily available in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia. So, things like that, right? All of that involves money. So whether it's more funding from the government, whether it's more corporate participation in terms of sponsorships, I definitely think a lot of these sports deserve more money. But the question of reallocation is the interesting one, because let's not kid ourselves, Malaysian football is nowhere close to some of the other sports that we excel in terms of the levels, right? Like Malaysian right. football, even our national team ranks still pretty low. The competition is a lot more severe in football. The gap is a lot bigger. The inequality is a lot bigger in football as well. But the idea of reallocating resources from football to everything else is an idea that I cannot 100% digest, only because we have to not necessarily look at it from a logical stand. I'll give you a simple example. Yeah? While the Olympics was going on, the Malaysian Super League was also going on, and matches that were being aired on YouTube were still getting close to 300,000-400,000 views. It is still very much a part of the social fabric. It is still very much a part of what the country wants. This is the sport that the country consumes. This is the sport that the country participates in the most. And it's that weekly community participation thing for me that separates it from every other sport. And there is a massive need to realign how we spend our money in football. I think there's a massive need to refocus and re-strategize the way wealth and money is distributed in football in terms of, you know, salaries. I think things are very inflated in Malaysian football at the moment. I think all of that needs to be, you know, there needs to be a reset button hit. There needs to be a a reimagination in terms of how things are done. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that we should put football on a logical pedestal with every other sport, and because it doesn't perform, we give it the least amount of funding. It's very difficult because, like, to me, as I mentioned, I think we have to view sports very differently. Like, the way we consume track cycling is very different to the way we participate in football, for example, with the ultras and these weekly trips to the stadiums and these weekly games, watching it at TV at home. So it's two different types of sports. So it's a very difficult discussion, to be honest. But the bottom line is, do I think all these other sports that we've got world-class athletes in deserve more funding? Yes. Full stop. Yes. Definitely deserve more funding.
I think that's a very interesting point you bring up about looking at sports as not just this thing, you know, it doesn't exist just so people can win medals, right? There's a lot more to the soul of sports than winning medal. Now, Kish, we are running a little short on time. So before we wrap up, you know, we've been talking a lot about Malaysia at the Olympics, this year's Olympics. But perhaps you can share a favorite moment of yours from the Olympics that doesn't necessarily involve a Malaysian.
Wow, there's a lot, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, I loved that high jump moment where the two athletes shared a gold medal.
Oh, I thought that's absolutely beautiful moment.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. You know, completely replicating the spirit of the Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. I also loved one of the weightlifters from, I think, Kiribati, an island, who, you know, completely fluffed his weightlifting attempt, but he celebrated it. He celebrated the fact that he was at the Olympics. He danced his way off the stage. You know, things like that really get to me, because it even in the context of football, is always very difficult to discuss with people about how it's not necessarily about winning all the time, right? It's about participation. It's about community participation. It's about just being there in the first place. And I think we got to solve a lot of it at the Olympics. You know, athletes that retain a very positive attitude despite not necessarily doing that well. All of those things were great. But I think my favorite story from the Olympics would probably be the Fiji Rugby Sevens team. Mm. It's crazy because Fiji is obviously a rugby mad nation. Make no mistakes. They're considered a decently sized powerhouse when it comes to rugby. But around them, around Fiji itself, from a geographical standpoint, you've got New Zealand and Australia, two countries with a massive reputation when it comes to rugby as well. And the Fiji Rugby Sevens team had to hitch a cargo flight that was carrying fish to get to Tokyo.
No way. Right?
They had to hitch a cargo flight that was carrying fish to get themselves to Tokyo. And in Tokyo, they defeated every single one of these boys, like from your Australians to your New Zealands. They even defeated Australia. I think it was like 19-0 in one of the games. They defeated Japan, the host, Great Britain, and all these countries were completely shoved aside until they faced New Zealand in the final, and they also won it, and they won the gold medal. And to me, that's just absolutely incredible. You know, like the fact that you've got this bunch of guys who had to, you know, for the lack of a better word, they had to just really busted so hard just to get themselves to the Olympics, and they had to, you know, do things like hitch a cargo flight with fishes to get to the Olympics, and the level of quality, the sheer level of domination that they showed at the Games was just something to behold. It was absolutely incredible. It was probably my favorite story alongside, I would say, Azrin Nabila's, right? I think I really, really loved Azrin Nabila's personal best record-breaking moment. I really loved it. It gave me goosebumps. It still gives me goosebumps until this moment when I think about it.
On that note, Kish, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. That's right.
I've been speaking with sports journalist Kishanan Sundaresan on Malaysia's journey in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. So if you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.